being in the UK, I'd find myself being a big fan of the English football team, but I could never bring myself to be a fan of the cricket team. I just couldn't. It's just too heavily ingrained in me, like growing up, that Australia is the only team that you can possibly support in cricket. So,
I can totally relate to that.
Yeah. The accreditation I had got me access to the tunnel in that game. And like before the match, standing in the players' tunnel with the players, with the sound of 80,000 people coming down the tunnel at Wembley, and there's Messi standing over there. It was just like one of the most surreal moments of my entire life. I started explaining it to him, and he just looked me dead in the eye, and he was just like so focused on every word that I was saying, and it just completely threw me. It just completely threw me, because I was not expecting him to just be so attentive. He's just like staring through me, like listening to every single word.
Imagine starting out filming your dog and backyard cricket games as a kid and ending up producing for FIFA, Netflix and UEFA, working with global icons like Cristiano Ronaldo and David Beckham along the way. That's the journey of Tim Groundwater, producer, videographer and creative mind behind some of the biggest sports projects on the planet. From shooting in 31 countries for FIFA's World Cup preview series to leading Netflix kickoff docuseries, Tim's story is proof that passion, persistence and a willingness to back yourself can take you anywhere. In this chat, we dive into the creative chaos of making world-class sports television, from the planning and teamwork it takes to pull off massive productions to the moments that make it all worthwhile. Fan stories from Tunisia and Morocco, a powerful haka in Auckland, and the surreal experience of directing Beckham himself. If you're a bloke who loves sport, creativity, or just the ideas of chasing something bigger than comfort, this episode's a masterclass in courage, craft, and carving your own path. I'm Ian Hawkins, and this is Sport is Life. The purpose of sport, as I see it, is to see your vision become a reality, find your voice, create strong connections, and learn to trust your body. Tim, how you going?
Doing all right, thanks, Ian. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Just tell you, it's a beautiful day here in Sydney. We've already been down the beach in sunny Coogee. How good. What a great part of the world.
I have indeed, mate. Yeah, I mean, this is the beauty of living in Australia. I've been in the UK for 10 years, and this is the stuff that I miss the most, so really enjoying it.
I did not even a full year in the UK because it started getting cold. I'm like, actually, this is not for me. How did you get through 10 UK winters?
With difficulty. I'm not going to lie. I never really got used to it. I kept expecting that, you know, over time, I'd start to get a bit more used to the weather, a bit more used to the winters in particular. But it never really happened. I mean, I used to enjoy December and Christmas lights went up and that kind of thing. But after Christmas, when all the lights came down and you had another couple of months of cold and dark, it was a bit bleak.
Yeah, yeah. The thing that just spun me out was you'd have these days that there was brilliant sunshine for about 5-6 hours, but it just never warmed up. Like even on a winter's day in Sydney, like the sun's out, you're going to at least feel warm, but it just never did.
Exactly. Yeah.
Culture shock.
Putting washing on the line and having it dry in 2 hours is just like incredible.
Yeah. That's what the internal heating's for, right, in the UK. Hanging outside. Anyway, we didn't come here to talk about the weather in the UK, but more about your sport TV production. But before we dive into that, let's talk a little bit about just your sporting background. Like, you grew up playing sport?
I did, yeah. So football, soccer and cricket were my two sports growing up. And my favourite sport would change every 6 months, depending on which sport was in season at that particular time. Yeah. I've got an older brother who's 2 years older than me, and he's massively into sport as well. So we're pretty competitive in the backyard growing up.
Reach any great heights?
I wouldn't say great heights. No, I mean, I played football, like representative football for Central Queensland when I was younger, and cricket as well. And, you know, had dreams of going all the way like any kid at that age. But, it didn't happen for me, unfortunately.
Like many of us, right? It's because we didn't get the opportunities. We're
yeah, that's what I put it down to.
Now, my journey into sports television was complete accident in a lot of ways. Just got offered a bit of work when I'd finished my teaching degree at uni, and I fell into it. But what about you? Like, is it? We talked about that sporting upbringing. Is it something you've always been fascinated and wanted to get into, or was it a bit?
Yeah, I mean, I'll try and give you the shortened version, I guess. But
we got ages, mate. Take as long as you need.
I mean, I originally studied business at university, which was the wrong thing for me. I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life, but I thought back on it recently, and when I was a kid, my parents had this little digital camera, and I used to make documentaries about my dog. Following my dog around and make documentaries, and then I'd also set up the camera behind the stumps in the backyard and you know, like film myself and my brother and my mate playing
the original stump cam.
Yeah, the original stump cam, exactly. Yeah. So I mean, all those kind of like skills and interests and stuff were there from a young age, but I just never really pieced it together that it could be a career for me. So I spent about a decade in my 20s working in jobs that I didn't particularly like, didn't have much of an interest in, and I kind of changed careers quite late in life. It was about when I was 29 that I made the decision to re-educate myself in something that I had a bit of an interest in. And I studied screen and media in Sydney full-time for 2 years, and then fortuitously, when I'd finished that, my girlfriend at the time wanted to move overseas, so we went to the UK, and I was sort of looking for jobs in film and television, sort of writing and directing in film and television, and I started seeing all these jobs advertised in sports TV, and it's not something that I'd ever thought of before. I'd never considered it, and I just sort of thought to myself, well, you know, I've got this qualification, I know a lot about sport, so I'll start applying for one of these jobs. And I walked into a job interview at a company called Sunset and Vine in London for a junior producer role, working on the ECB contract, working on the cricket there. And, you know, he started asking me questions about cricket and eventually had to say, "It's all right, mate, you can stop. Like, I get it. You know what you're talking about." Just chewed his ear off about cricket.
Yeah. You knew more than him, obviously.
Yeah. And so that was my in. And from there, I was lucky enough to get a job working on the UEFA Champions League magazine show at IMG, which just kind of, and everything just sort of took off from there.
How good. And do you find that because you had that sports interest and you'd been learning about, well, you've been shooting documentary since you were a kid, as it turns out, did you find that it came pretty easy to you?
Yeah, I did. I mean, like anything, right? Like, if you've got a passion about something, then it tends to come easier to you. And you know, like once I'm working in cricket, I'm working in football, it never seemed like a job to me. I was excited to go in. I was excited to try and create something new and tell stories. I remember at IMG once I was making a feature on Brazilian Ronaldo, and he was one of my absolute heroes growing up, and I just had this moment where I just thought, how lucky am I that I get to craft a story and tell Ronaldo's story to the world. It was, you know, I had a few moments like that over the years, but yeah, that was definitely one of them.
So good. Yeah, I mean, I think I speak for most people at Fox Sports because they're all sports fans essentially, that there's so many pinch yourself moments going, I can't believe they're paying me for this stuff.
Like, yeah. Yes. Yeah. I had quite a few of those over the years.
He was a god to all the number nines, actually. Van Basten, definitely Brazilian Ronaldo, Shearer, I won't go back in even older names and show my age, but yeah, like he was, I think a lot of the sort of next generation don't understand just how good he was, because what they saw of him potentially was those later years when he'd been injured and he'd put on weight.
Yeah.
And
that's
he was doing pretty amazing things, but only a shadow of what he was doing in those years.
Yeah. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of big name players over the years, and he's definitely at the top of the list in terms of people saying he's the best I ever played with or against.
Oh, wow. I remember a mate of mine was, he was traveling, he was in Barcelona, and they were, I think they were playing, I think it was the a big one. I think it was against Madrid, down 3-0 at halftime, and Ronaldo comes on and scores 4 in the second half to win it.
Yeah.
And just because he was untouchable.
He was, yeah.
Which was the World Cup where he just ran riot?
2002, I think, in Japan, Korea, when he sort of won it for me. He was expected to do that in 98 and had sort of that LPL issue in the final. But, what a player.
Next level. Yeah. And when you look at players like that, like, and you're creating vision around them, like, what's the impression you're trying to create with the viewer? Are you trying to almost take them onto the field? Are you trying to get them to get that perspective of the greatness? Like, what angle do you come from?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it all depends on what the feature or that particular story calls for. I mean, you could be making a story on Ronaldo that's very technical and, you know, talks about, you know, his technical ability on the pitch and why he was able to do the things that he was able to do. And then you might come at it from a completely different angle and you try to sort of bring out more of his personality and who he was as a man. And I sort of tried to do a little bit of both. It was only a short sort of 4 or 5 minute feature that I was making on him. But, you know, the thing that struck me about him and, you know, Ronaldinho was the same, as that he used to play with a big smile on his face. I know he's got his teeth fixed now, but he used to have that big gap between his front teeth and you just see this big gappy smile on the guy. And I just kind of like wanted to try and bring out, you know, that part of his personality in the story that I was telling.
Oh, I love it. I actually saw something on LinkedIn the other day from a sports psychologist talking about how that way that Ronaldinho used to play was so effective because he just left his divots behind. Like, he was smiling. He would laugh off. Like, he'd make a mistake and he would laugh.
Yeah.
And then even talking about the wizardry of him, he would do deliberate bad touches to draw people into certain positions on the field and then just burn them. And it's like...
He was an absolute class above, just a different level, that guy. Yeah. So good to watch.
Yeah. I know the footballers that I played with when they were sort of coming through to 20 and I'm sort of heading out the back door at 30-odd, that they all claimed that Ronaldinho was the greatest of all time. And I'm like, well, I think we're always biased from our generation, aren't we? So I can't go past Maradona myself, but there's certainly plenty of talent there.
A little genius.
Yeah. So you've like just gone straight. Let's go back to, you talked about you wanted to move into something that you had a passion for. Not everyone has that courage or has that ability to take that action. Like, did you have to go through a really challenging moment to get to that point just to go, I've got to get out of here?
Yeah, I did, very much so. And looking back at it now, so I was working in sales. I was doing a sales job that I hated and you know, I'm not a salesman. And I was trying and I was hating it and I was hating myself for doing it. And in a way, I think I was fortunate that I hated what I was doing so much that it forced me to change. I think if I was doing something that was just kind of okay, I could have just kept coasting. And I'm so, so glad that I didn't. So, you know, I had a moment where I thought to myself, do you want to do this for the next 30, 40 years? Absolutely not. So what are your options? You know, I wasn't really qualified to do anything else. So my only option really was to go back to study and retrain myself in something that I had a real interest in. And I mean, for sure there were times, plenty of times where I wondered if I'd done the right thing.
Yeah. Especially and it was with the earning potential changes for a period of
time. Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it was a long slog from making the decision to getting my first job working in sports television was probably 4 or 5 years. And, you know, at that age, late 20s, early 30s, you know, there were plenty of moments where I was questioning whether I'd done the right thing. But, yeah, I mean, it's all worked out.
Yeah. I think any leap of faith like that has those moments. It's almost like a test to see if it's what you really want. Are you really prepared to go? And right. I think you do come to a point where you're like, yeah, there's the idea of turning back has some comfort and safety. But for me personally, but it sounds like you're the same. It's like, okay, that's an option, but really I could never go back to those boring days that were almost soulless in what you were doing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, time's finite, right? So really got to think hard about how we want to use it.
100%. And I think for me, that didn't come until much later in life. Like I was my late 30s, and I think, unfortunately, it is often from dark times that people eventually get to that point. But again, it says so much for you, courage, that you're prepared to do it, because many just aren't. I speak to people my age all the time that, oh, man, you must love what you're doing. You've been doing it for so long. And they're like, it's all right.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. Or they're just, they're tied to a paycheck or
exactly
or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. As I say, I could easily have ended up one of those people. So I'm sort of thankful for how it's turned out.
Yeah. And one of the things that I really enjoyed reading about what you've done is how much travel you've got to do. Like for me, who just loves travel, that just sounds like ideal. Now, I know the truth is that there are different times where you're sort of flying in, flying out to get the piece or quick interview or whatever it is. But you've also must have had some great travel experiences throughout filming these documentaries and these programs.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's hard to know where to start, really. The job that I got with the Champions League magazine show in the UK was an incredible sort of 3 or 4 years that I worked on that show. It wasn't the highest paid job in the world, but the experiences that I got to have were just unbelievable. I was sort of traveling during the football season. I was traveling probably on average every second week. And I was traveling to, you know, Champions League matches, going to clubs to interview players at the training centre, and, you know, going around the city to film fan stories. And, it took me to some incredible places and some incredible matches. I was at the Atletico Madrid Real Madrid Champions League semi-final derby at the Bernabeu when Ronaldo scored a hat-trick. I was standing behind the goal in front of the Kop when Liverpool came back from 3-0 down in the second leg to beat Barcelona 4-3 at Anfield.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, just some – and, I mean, look, you talk about pinch-me moments. There's a couple of seasons where Tottenham were playing their home games at Wembley. And I was there in a group stage match when they played against Barca, when Messi was still there. And the accreditation that I had got me access to the tunnel in that game. Before the match, standing in the players' tunnel with the players, with the sound of 80,000 people coming down the tunnel at Wembley, and there's Messi standing over there. It was just like one of the most surreal moments of my entire life. Still crazy to think about it. The travel opportunities were just unbelievable. And it takes you to some places that you would never go to otherwise, which is one of the things that I loved about it.
Take us through a few of those examples.
Yeah, I found myself in a place called Östersund in Sweden, just a tiny little town in Sweden that made it to the Europa League 1 year. I think Graham Potter was actually the manager there at the time.
Yeah, right.
I was there to film a city profile, and we were there in January. It was myself and a cameraman, and it was minus 20 degrees, and I wasn't prepared for that at all. I was like, I was wearing jeans and sneakers and like just about as many coats as I could put on. And we were having to go and film around this tiny little town. And, you know, like the sun would come up for about 3 or 4 hours during the day. But when the sun was out, the light was, it was basically just like filming at magic hour the whole time that the sun was up. And we had this car, this little car with heated seats, and we'd drive around, we'd heat the seats up, and then we'd like run out and film for like 5 or 10 minutes. And my cameraman's filming and I'm standing next to him doing star jumps just to try and like keep myself warm. And then we'd run back to the car and yeah, so yeah, some crazy experiences like that. That's probably the, that's one that really stands out. Yeah, never really forgotten about that.
Yeah, wow, you must have met some incredible people too. Like, have you got any fan story or like players, fans, or maybe a combination, maybe a couple of different stories?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of like players, never really get, maybe at the very beginning you get a little bit nervous in front of big players, but I think after a while when it's your job and you're doing it every week, you sort of lose that starstruckness. Yeah. But one that definitely was when I met David Beckham in Monaco before the Champions League draw, and we were filming a story on him. And normally, you know, when you do an interview, you have the least amount of people in the room as possible because you want the, you know, the person you're interviewing to feel comfortable and like a nice intimate setting. There's probably about 20 or 30 people in the room because everyone wanted to see him. Everyone wanted to be there. And I was directing the shoot, and he came in with an entourage of people as well. And normally when you do these kind of shoots with big name players, you might try to explain to them how the interview is going to go, what you're going to ask them about, what kind of B-roll you might ask them to film. And most of the time they're looking around the room. Yeah, yeah, fine. You know, whatever. I started explaining it to him and he just looked me dead in the eye and he was just like so focused on every word that I was saying and it just completely threw me. It just completely threw me because I was not expecting him to just be so attentive. And he was just, he's just like staring through me, like listening to every single word. And I mean, the guy was so well media trained. He was kind of like very serious about everything. And then he sat down and, you know, roll camera and just this like bright, bubbly sort of friendly persona came out. And I'm sure that is part of his personality, but he was just kind of like in the groove.
Yeah. True professional. And it sounds like super respectful too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's the thing that, that surprised me the most. Was just that he was, you know, like compared to the other names that you get to interview, like he's, you know, he's the top of the top, basically, David Beckham. And so you kind of just have this assumption that the higher you go with people, the less time they're going to give you in terms of like taking you seriously as a person or as a producer or whatever. And he was the complete opposite. He was, you know, he was listening to everything and taking it all very seriously and taking very seriously, so it was a nice surprise.
I could just imagine though how disconcerting that would be because you're not expecting to get that much back from them.
Yeah, exactly. And he was actually, he's a lot taller than I imagined him to be as well, so it's like a combination of those two things. It's like, okay.
Yeah, right. I remember watching him play at the old Wembley back in 98 when he was playing. It's probably at the height of his powers, really, when he was playing central midfield for England, and it was just a masterclass. The Czech Republic, who were a good side back then, absolutely tore them apart. It was really good to watch. And I think probably people forget because, you know, the later years where he was essentially very good at the crossing the ball, still probably the best that there's ever been at doing that, that people forget just what a good, like, all-round footballer he used to be.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think he was runner-up in the Ballon d'Or one year. And, yeah, I remember going back through a whole lot of old footage of his when I was doing the story on him. And I think before I'd done that, I'd forgotten how good he was in his pomp as well. Yeah. You know, beating players on the outside and, you know, much more rounded ball than just crossing the ball, like you say.
Yeah, absolutely. It was the most – it had reminded me of someone playing that sort of Gascoigne role, coming deep, getting the ball, distributing, getting it back, that I'd that I can remember. And again, it's probably only for a small window and many people probably forget.
Yeah.
But
yeah, that's right. Yeah.
What about some, like, you're going into all these really unique places. Did you get much interaction with fans and then wanting to know what you were doing and having some cool interactions with them?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there were times where we'd line up a fan in advance. You know, you'd research someone and find someone who's got a good fan story and arrange to do a story on them. But then there's other times where you're just walking around and trying to find whoever you can to give you a good soundbite. I mean, the last project that I did was the first 6 months of this year, filming and producing all the content for the FIFA Club World Cup Trophy Tour.
Yep.
So that took me to 21 countries it was this year, 35 cities, taking the trophy to every club that was going to be playing in the tournament. And then each club would put on events around the city for their fans to come and look at the trophy and take photos with the trophy and what have you. And so, yeah, there was a lot more opportunity to mingle with the fans there. And it was really interesting seeing the difference because we went to every continent. And it was really interesting seeing the difference in the fans in each place, and how seriously each club was taking it. I mean, you had everything from Manchester City, where they put the trophy in their club shop in a shopping centre for a few hours, and that was their event. And you just had a lot of sort of influencers coming along to do stuff with the trophy there. And then you kind of compare that with when we were at Esperance in Tunis, and they had thousands of people, literally thousands of people, trying to get in to take a photo with the trophy. It turned into like chaos, basically. Like the police were there. You had people getting squashed up against the gate trying to get in. It was just madness. And I remember commenting on how crazy the Tunis fans were, and one of the locals was with us. Is that you think this is crazy? You wait till you get to Morocco.
Wasn't he wrong?
He was not wrong at all. It was mad. I was working at the Club World Cup this year, and the team from Morocco were in Manchester City's group. And I was there with Manchester City, so they played each other the first game, and the Moroccan fans in the stand. I don't think the US security were prepared for them. I don't think they'd seen anything like Moroccan football fans before. Yeah. You had like they were trying to tell them to sit down at one stage. It's like you guys have got absolutely no chance. And one of the security guys decided to jump into the crowd at one stage, and we just never saw him again.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
I think it must have been one of your pieces because I saw the piece on Auckland FC.
Okay,
going into that little clubhouse,
Auckland City.
Yeah.
And
I really enjoyed that. So it's funny. Like I can't remember where I saw that now. Would it have been doing the rounds on social media at some point or YouTube maybe?
It could have been, yeah. So it would have been on FIFA's YouTube channel. I think Auckland FC, I think they might have reposted it as well.
Maybe on their own
channels.
Yeah.
That was a pretty special stop, actually. That was definitely one of the highlights of the tour, Auckland, yeah.
Yeah,
the only non-professional team in the competition, obviously.
Yeah, and like what a ride for those guys.
Yeah,
like, and self-funded. Yeah. I'm not sure they did some fundraising as well, but and they weren't awful either, were they? In the tournament, non-professional team, they did incredibly well.
Yeah, to get a draw with Boca is unbelievable. I mean, I was worried. The group that they were in with Bayern and Benfica and Boca and nothing, you know, it was 10-0 or something, their first game against Bayern. So here we go. And managed to draw against Boca, which is unreal.
That's right. Was it that last game of the tournament maybe?
Might have been, yeah.
Yeah. But again, that's football, isn't it? That's the beauty of football. It's like one of the few sports where there can be that much of a leveler.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%. Mm. Yeah, I was really happy for them actually. They were a really, really good bunch of people, treated us really well.
Yeah. So what about What about a particular story that you've enjoyed and that you really were proud of the outcome of just the picture it was able to paint of a certain situation?
Oh, wow. That's a good question. I mean, look, I'm just going to go to the most recent ones that I've worked on first. And you know, you mentioned Auckland. Auckland was definitely one of them. Just such a unique stop on the tour and such a unique story to tell. And you know, we were really lucky in terms of what they offered us as well. So we got a traditional Maori welcome on the marae there in Auckland, which is not something that a lot of people get to experience. And they welcomed us into that ceremony, which was really powerful and very special and allowed us to film it as well.
Yeah.
They took us to a high school, and it's a high school that's affiliated with the club, and the players go there and do coaching sessions, free coaching sessions with the kids. And some of the prize money that they were getting from the Club World Cup, they were donating to that school to build an all-weather football pitch for them. And you know, like how incredible is that? You know, like they're getting a couple of million dollars, which for them is, you know, massive compared to what that would mean for some of the bigger clubs. Yeah. And they're still donating that to their local community, which I thought was incredible. But we went along with them to the school, and there was a few hundred school kids there, and they performed a haka for us, like a couple of hundred kids together. They'd been practicing this for months, and they performed a haka for us. So, you know, when you have little moments like that, to be able to piece those together into a story is unbeatable, really. And that combined with the guys talking about what it was going to mean for them as, you know, real estate agents and salesmen and what have you, to go and be playing against the likes of Harry Kane and, yeah, and, you know, like it was just a real gift of a story. So, you know, I really, really enjoyed that. I think the other massive project, well, one of them that I've worked on in the past was the 2022 FIFA World Cup, the Men's World Cup preview series. And we did 16 episodes of that, 16 half an hour episodes. So each episode was two teams, 32 teams in the tournament.
Yeah.
And that was that was a crazy, crazy project. But some great stories came out of it. And one in particular that stands out, not so much the story, but it's just the way that it came together. And it was, we were trying to do a story with Cameroon, and Cameroon were proving very, very difficult to get anything out of at all, an interview with a player, anything. Like, it was really, really challenging. And I'd come up with an idea to sort of use a couple of local actors to try and tell the story of Cameroon at the Club World, at the World Cup. And I don't know how we pulled it off. I had an excellent DOP and an excellent producer who flew out there to Cameroon. And we found a guy with a taxi and an actor to play the taxi driver. And he drove around the city picking up passengers, and they would discuss different moments in Cameroon's World Cup history, and we would kind of use that to flash back to these different moments. And the whole thing just, I also had a fantastic editor who managed to pull it all together. And I mean, I don't know what anyone else thought of it, but that was one of the proudest moments for me, just the fact that it did actually come together, because it was a pretty outrageous idea.
It's such a great idea. And also, like, if you think about from a cultural aspect and just how excited they would be about their team, and then the moments, like the first one that comes to mind is Roger Miller in 1990.
Yeah.
And,
I
imagine those passengers like would really light up when they were telling the stories.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, they're so passionate about it, and everyone was like talking about it like it happened yesterday, you know. So, yeah, it was great.
All coming together. Having worked in sports television and having to deal with a whole lot of very interesting characters in that production space, and all very good, but often some interesting interactions around ego, and some of them a bit too much about them and not enough about the content. Like that, I get quite the opposite vibe from you. Everything that you've talked about, it's all been about the story, and it's all been about the subject. What what do you think is it is about you that differentiates from other people that are working in a space? Because I'm sure you've come across plenty of interesting characters as well.
Yeah, I have. And I think, you know, in any line of work, you're going to get people who challenge you in a good way and also sometimes in a not so good way. I mean, one of the things that I love about this job and this industry is that it's a true collaboration. I know that sounds obvious and maybe a little bit cheesy, but, I mean, you can't do anything in this industry on your own. You know, you need a great editor, you need a great DOP, you need a great production manager, you need a great archive producer. And, you know, like one man, one woman, you can't do anything by yourself. So I love the collaborative nature of it. But that, of course, will bring you into situations where sometimes you're going to butt heads with people, where maybe you'll have different ideas. I like to think that I've been able to find a way over the years to work with most personality types. And I think if you get people who are passionate and if you get people who are trying to serve the story and serve the production, then I think you can always find a way to work together. I think it's when you find yourself working with someone who is working to sort of serve themselves and isn't too bothered about how the story or the production turns out, that's when you've got a real problem. And I think that's when you need to look at maybe working with someone else. But I think, you know, if you've got someone there who you can see has the passion and the same desire to create something great the same as you do, then I'll always have that respect for them, have enough respect for them, for their drive and for their passion to try and find a way to work it out.
Yeah, I love it. Let's get down to some of the nitty-gritty now, because I know some of the people watching are in television, sports production or something similar. How do you approach so you've given this project, what are some of the steps you go through? Obviously not going into all the nerdy television and production side of it, but just from a process-oriented perspective, sort of how do you sort of set the whole thing up to get the best results?
So I can't do my job without 100 spreadsheets, basically. I'm a bit of a spreadsheet nerd. Like my projects live on spreadsheets. And I don't know how people do it any other way, to be honest with you. But I think trying to break it down into its simplest parts, because, you know, you get handed a project like, you know, I'll use the example of the 2022 preview series where we had 16 episodes. You've got 32 sort of 15-minute features to make. You've got 32 countries to film in. You've got 32 crews to find. Each story needs to be unique. You've got to find your voiceover artist, et cetera, et cetera. It feels monumental. And it feels like, you know, I'm not going to lie, like that project in particular, at the start, I just thought, how the hell am I going to do this?
Yeah.
Like the scope of it was so big that it becomes overwhelming. But being able to just break it down into manageable parts and just focusing on one thing at a time is really how I got through that. And you know, like you have to be uber organized, super organized. What are your most important tasks for that day? Those come first, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, you'll read similar things in a lot of books that talk about time management and creating good habits. And I mean, they all talk about the same stuff for a reason, right? Because it works.
Yeah.
And that's the only way that you can manage it. So, yeah, I mean, I would advise anyone that isn't currently a spreadsheet warrior that has big tasks at hand or big projects at hand to get on Google Sheets or get on Excel and teach yourself how to do it, because it's going to change the way that you organize your life.
Agree. I think it comes back to what you said before about the different personalities. So I'm kind of other side of the personality spectrum to spreadsheets. I do have the added advantage of having a wife who's sounds a bit like you in terms of she's a spreadsheet wizard. So
yeah.
So when I
yeah.
get stuck on that, I'm like, I've got all this shit in my head that I need to unpack. I need you to help me get it into some sense. Again, the importance of team, right? But yeah, I think that if you're talking about any high performance habit, it's got to come with getting it all down on paper and actually mapping it out. And it's amazing how many people do that in their professional life, but then when it comes to other areas of their life, they can neglect it. So it's a really good point you make, and one that I think, yeah, for those listening, you should take a particular note of and how valuable that is.
Yeah, 100%.
All right, so let's get now more into, okay, you've set the whole thing up. Then how do you go about, because you mentioned before you come up with an idea, for each different element of the project, are you having to go through that creative process every time? Or is some of it just kind of like it writes itself and it's already there just staring you in the face? How does that process go?
I think it's a little bit of both. And I think over the years, once you've worked in the industry for that long, not only have you, you've created a lot of content yourself, you've worked with some very talented and creative people and you've seen a lot of things that they've created. You've done a lot of research over the years to try and come up with different ideas. I mean, there's definitely, like I'll have a page that's just like almost like a scrapbook of ideas, like I'll just grab little videos or it might be a photo or a bit of art or something that just kind of like inspires an idea or inspires a creative style or something, and just try to keep a book of those that I can kind of refer to and go back to. But I think also, very occasionally you just see something so original and an idea that you've never seen before, and you're just like, oh man, you've knocked that out of the park, that's awesome. But like more often than not, you're seeing a different version of an idea that's been done before, that's been slightly repackaged. And, it's just like the nature of the beast, right? Like we're all producing content all the time. Like it's just not possible to come up with a completely new, original, groundbreaking idea every week, especially, like when you're working on a weekly show or something like that. So, you do have sort of like this bank of ideas that you've seen before that you can draw on and try to take inspiration from and maybe, put your own spin on it. And then as I say, occasionally you just get like the hallelujah moment where just something completely original comes to you, and you just got to be thankful when that happens.
Yeah, absolutely. It made me think of musicians. Like they talk about how, well, none of our music is necessarily coming from completely new idea. It's like all
That's
the influences
right.
that we've had over yeah. our life, even in what everyone, like everyone listening as well, like it's pulling those different experiences that we've had and making it work for whatever you're working on now. Can you remember one of those experiences, whether it was in television or prior to that, that really left a mark on you, that you were like, oh wow, that's something I hadn't really thought about before that I need to make sure I include in other areas of my life, and not spreadsheets either, something else?
Sorry, something from the creative process, do you mean?
Just anything, like anything that you've learned from someone else or you witnessed and you thought, wow, I can make sure I bring that into my toolkit for a future reference, because that actually looks amazing.
Look, I think working on that in UEFA Productions at IMG at the time that I did was the best possible training ground that I think anyone could hope to have in sports television. I was working under and alongside some extremely talented, dedicated, hardworking people. And, that Champions League magazine show was sort of like the pinnacle of non-live football content in Europe. I think, at least we like to think so anyway, but compared to a lot of other stuff that was out there, it was really high quality content. And the fact that it was being turned around on a weekly basis, we'd sort of go and film a Champions League match somewhere in Europe. The match might finish at midnight. You'd be at the airport at 4 a.m. to fly back to London with the rushes. And at 8 o'clock, you'd be in the edit suite. You'd finish the edit at 9 p.m. and the show goes out the next day. You know, like that was the kind of turnaround that we were working on. But I think working with a few guys who sort of wouldn't accept anything but perfection. And I don't mean in that as though like really hard taskmasters, but it was just not letting you settle for something that wasn't as good as you could make it. You know, doing that on a weekly show as well is crazy. And I can remember being, in edit suite with one of the series producers quite early on in my time there. And the show was supposed to go out that night. And I can remember him getting the editor to trial 3 or 4 different sound effects for a flag waving in the wind until he found the right one. And I was like, all right, so this is like the level that we're aiming for here.
Yeah, wow. Or is your head's like, come on, let's get this done. We've got a deadline to meet.
Yeah, I mean, I'd never thought that much about how those tiny little details can make such of a difference. So just, you know, being that environment and just like, I guess, just learning that extreme attention to detail was something that's held me in really good stead for the years that came after.
Love it. From a programming perspective at Fox, we're often getting those IMG magazine shows, and we'd always be disappointed in how few people in Australia actually tuned in for them, because they were some of the best programming that we showed, and they were like boxing documentaries, you know, lead up to big fights. There was the football programs. There was like a whole lot of the behind the scenes stuff around a whole lot of obscure sports. Sunset and Vine and IMG did a few bit of the sailing stuff, which again was such great stories, but it's like almost like hidden gems. I mean, I don't know, obviously there was an audience in other parts of the world, but yeah, they were always high quality stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're still getting made, and they still go out in Australia. I'm not sure what the viewership's like, but it's great content.
Yeah, absolutely. What a couple of questions about like your sort of creative ideas. If you had a blank slate, what would you love to sink your teeth into? What sort of project? What sport? What out there that are you seeing that you'd be like, oh, if I could get my hands on that, I could do a fantastic job?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that there's, you know, I've only been back in the country for a couple of months, but after being away for 10 years, but it seems to me like there's a real opportunity here for some additional non-live content around sport, especially on these streaming platforms. You know, like the way that people are consuming content these days is so much more about video on demand and, you know, sort of shorter bits of content. I know there's definitely still a place for long-form documentaries. I think maybe sports documentaries has been saturated somewhat in recent times, but just like those short sort of like 3 to 5 minute features and magazine show style features that can sit independently on streaming platforms and on YouTube pages. I think there's a real opportunity there in Australia for that content to be made. And I, you know, like being back in Australia now with the summer of cricket coming up, like it's been a long time since I worked on cricket. Yeah. And you know, like being in the UK, I'd find myself being a big fan of the English football team, but I could never bring myself to be a fan of the cricket team. I just couldn't. It's just too heavily ingrained in me, like growing up, that Australia is the only team that you can possibly support in cricket. So
relate to that.
Yeah. But yeah, being back on Australian shores again, would be really keen to sink my teeth into some cricket content, and you know, like especially with India being here this summer, I think it's going to be huge. So would love to get into sort of some match night features and things like that, because I think they do really well here in Australia.
Yeah,
absolutely. And you think about all the different platforms and places that those short pieces could go. I think that just makes total sense. I love that. What about, okay, you've kind of ticked this box in this next question, but what about something you see for the future of sport? So you've talked about those smaller pieces, but is there something else in TV production, like a trend that you could see unfolding in the future, given just how like technology is advancing so quickly? Yeah. Like, can you kind of see where that's heading?
I think it can't be long until the virtual reality experience becomes a big part of sport. I tried the Apple goggles. Can't remember what they're called, but I tried those. And one of the demo videos is of being at Madison Square Garden, sitting in the front row and watching an NBA game. And it was just mind blowing because it was literally like you're sitting there in the front row at Madison Square Garden watching an NBA game. And I just thought, holy crap, like this, obviously the technology has to get to a point where it's accessible to everyone. And it is a very different viewing experience because, it's not like you sit in a room with a group of mates and watch the cup final or whatever, and you're all there cheering together. And, if you've got a mask on, then that's a very different experience. But the fact that it is so immersive and just feels so real, I just think that there's definitely going to come a point where that skyrockets. And I think once they get them to a point where they're more affordable for an average viewer, and the technology catches up to a point where it's not going to be glitchy and it's affordable enough to produce and affordable enough to consume, I can see that taking off for sure.
Oh, that sounds fantastic. So you could even the same thing, the tiers of the tickets where your virtual experience comes from. There's no reason why the technology can't be so immersive that you can be there with your mates so that you're all having an interactive experience courtside at the Lakers, for example, but all through your own goggles. I never really thought about that, but that sounds fantastic. My only negative thought around that was well, if it gets that good, will anyone go to the games?
It's a good question. I guess if you got Madison Square Garden down the road and you have the option of going down there, then maybe you would, but obviously sitting there in your bedroom over here in Australia, you don't have that option.
Cheaper beer, hotter pies.
there you go.
I think I'm an energy junkie, long suffering para fan, and having season tickets, and some weeks just going, I don't want to go. But the moment I sort of walking towards the stadium where the crowds start to gather and you feel the vibe of the crowd, you're like, okay,
yeah. They'll never be any real substitute for that. And I think that's why, AI, what's the future of that? Who really knows? But I don't think it's ever going to replace live sport because it just can't. That unscripted drama is impossible to replicate. So, that's always going to be there.
Yeah, and I follow a fair few people in marketing and trends and that sort of thing, and they're all saying the same thing. What is going to unfold in the coming years is live events, community things, services, places where people can go where they actually have to hand their phone in. That's where we're going to head, because everything else is going to be so automated and so taken care of that we're going to crave, ultimately, we're still going to crave that human connection. So I think you're spot on the money there. And it'll be interesting. There might be an angle there for you too. Is what sort of live events, even just thinking about it now, the Ashes coming up, I know the guys the great cricketers, I'm sure they'll have live events, but I'm sure there's some sort of fan experience you could create, which you could do yeah, some sort of television experience in the lead up to an Ashes test. Like I'm even just thinking about game day, like, you know, the ritual that all those people, I'll come from a Sydney perspective, they often come from out of town or they get the train in from up the coast, from the mountains, whatever. And then the crowds, you know, you can see them when you're driving past your local station. There's people there dressed in their cricket gear. And then when you're on the train or public transport, and then you see more and more of these people, and you get to Central, and then, I mean, it used to be the walk up the hill. Now they've got the light rail, but that whole experience, obviously you couldn't film the whole thing because people would quickly get bored, but just sort of tapping into that real energy of that, of something that people are so familiar with. I reckon there might be something there.
Yeah, I totally agree. And, you know, like, there's been such a huge interest, and it's because of these sports docs that it sort of exploded, this whole kind of like interest in behind the scenes footage, and, you know, being in the dressing room, being on the team bus, being in the hotel, and just kind of like feeling like you're a part of the team. Remember watching some old footage of, you know, like World Cup videos, World Cup official films, and every now and again they'd throw in some scenes of like the team back in, you know, like the England team back in like the 80s, you know, like kicking back by the pool or something and having a chat, and that stuff was absolute gold. But, you know, it was never a massive part of sports television and filmmaking, whereas now you know, that's really the go-to. That's what everyone's aiming for. It's just access, access, access. Who can get the best access? Who can get closest? Who can get the most personal soundbite? And it's just like everyone sort of trying to one-up the previous production as to sort of how immersed you can be within the team. And I think it sort of got to a point where I think you're starting to get pushback from players and from coaches, and you know, like you hear stories of like the all or nothing where they went in and it had been approved by the club, but it didn't have the buy-in of the players, and it kind of suffers because of that. And I think initially, you know, when the idea first started to come out, I think maybe the clubs and the players were sort of excited about being able to tell their story and everything, but I think it certainly got to the point where immersive became sort of intrusive for these guys, and I think sort of now it's about trying to find the balance.
Well, we mentioned Nick Piper, who's been a former guest on this show, and that's the sort of stuff he's done. He's working with the Dolphins at the moment. He's got that down to a fine art. So I don't know if you've already spoken to him, but I imagine when you two talk, you'll come up with something that'll be revolutionary.
Sounds like he's done really well cultivating the relationships that he's done, which is obviously a huge part of it. And you know, if you can get yourself to a point where you're essentially, you know, part of the wallpaper and you're just there and you're accepted as part of the team, then, you know, that's the ultimate goal.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think if you look at it from a historical perspective, you mentioned that old footage around the pool. Like, there was one that came to mind, Italia 90. There was a few stories there, and they had some overlay footage of it. I'm like, for historical relevance and looking back at those tournaments, I think that stuff people would eat that up. Like, I listen to these guys, British football, Under the Cosh. I don't know if you've seen those guys. There's three guys. One of them is an ex-footballer. I don't know if they all are. And they interview, like, former players. And they're telling old stories. And you see little bites on social media. You can go to YouTube, watch the whole thing. And, mate, I love that stuff. I love it. And I wasn't even, like, I was an English football fan, but, like, I'm familiar with a lot of these personalities. But, like, It's an educational piece. I remember the late great Kevin Campbell. He was on there. They ended up coming back and doing two episodes because his stories about, because he went abroad, and a lot of people, you know, English football fans wouldn't have known the journey, and he told some incredible stories. And I think there's such an opportunity there for things that people can look back at with a whole new perspective of these historical moments.
You wonder how much of that footage still exists, you know, because like they obviously were filming some of that stuff, and like a fraction of it makes it into the into the official films. And yeah, like you just wonder how much of it's sitting in a vault somewhere, and it's absolute gold, that stuff. So yeah, I mean, good archive producer, worth their weight in gold.
Yeah. Someone's got a bunch of 1 inches under their bed or something somewhere, probably. As good as they were, some of those deteriorate. My first job, incidentally, was working at a tape library, carrying around a lot of those old 1 inches, and then going on that journey with Fox Sports where we went to digital and then went to online. And that was one of my favorite jobs, is to find some of that archive footage. Like, how can we repurpose some of this stuff? And that was
one. When you find it, it's absolute gold, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, like I'd get distracted watching an old game or something, and then realize I've actually got a job to do here. And actually, one of the things I found was an old Panasonic Cup game with the opener, the opening music, which like was a sound I'd just fallen in love with as a kid, and now it's still my ringtone. It's been there for 10 years, and it just like, well, I love it. So I reckon you're onto or something there around that. The stuff that goes with hand in hand with the actual event, just based on what I like and what I've seen actually gets traction on social media. I think there's something there for sure, mate. So Tim, where can people find, you've mentioned some of your work, but do you have like somewhere where people can come and or go and look at some of the things you've created, some of the stories, like website or?
Absolutely, So Green Corn is the name of my company, Green Corn Productions, and greencorn.tv is where anyone can go to have a look. There's some examples of recent work on there and jump on and have a look. It would be great.
Awesome. Before we jump off, is there anything else that you feel like an experience or just something about the whole production experience that you'd love to share with the audience?
I think I'm just excited for the next chapter, you know, like it tends to go in chapters in your life, right? This is the beginning of a new one now, being back in Australia on home soil. I mean, I didn't even work in sports television when I left. And have come back with all this experience behind me and all these amazing experiences that I've been able to have. So I've been in touch with quite a few people since I've been back, just getting to know who's in the industry over here, and it's great to just see so many good potential collaborators out there in Australia as well, and there's a lot of people who've got in contact with me to kind of offer up their services, and I'm just really excited to get going in Australia, to be honest, mate.
Love it. Well, I definitely think people should follow you and see what's next, because from everything you've already created and from this chat today, like you're going to be producing more quality stuff for the world to see. I appreciate you coming on and sharing some of the process and some of those magic moments that only sport can create. I've really enjoyed the chat, and thanks for coming on, Tim.
Yeah, me too. It's been a great chat, Ian. Thanks for having me.
Welcome. Tim's story is a reminder that success isn't always about chasing the biggest stage. It's about backing yourself when comfort starts to feel like a cage. From filming his dog as a kid to producing global documentaries, his journey shows what happens when you follow your curiosity, stay patient through the struggle, and commit to mastering your craft. Whether you're leading a business, building a team, or chasing a dream, the same rules apply. Surround yourself with good people, plan with precision, and stay true to what lights you up. That's where real momentum begins, and the courage to create your own game. You've taken the time to listen to this whole episode. Now it's time to take action. Commit to one thing you've learned today and make it happen. And to avoid any obstructions, join the Sport is Life movement by clicking on the link in the show notes.